when I opened it, and so I just wanted to say thank you if you're listening.
Beautiful. And we want you to stay tuned. You're tuned to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Catherine, and you can email heartofmindradio@gmail.com or call and leave a message at 347-480-1694. Or you can go to the website qigongonline.net. Have a wonderful week. I invite you to join me on Friday morning, 10 a.m. at prn.fm for a rendition of Heart of Mind Radio. It's different than the one you hear on Mondays here at WBAI. And tune in next Wednesday at midnight for Earth at Midnight with Catherine and Paulette. Stay tuned.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With me this morning, Sam J. Miller, no longer just Shirley Jackson award-winning Sam J. Miller, but also Nebula nominated. Oh, his name's getting too long. Sam Miller is here. Stay tuned. It's not supposed to play that twice in a row, now is it? It was supposed to neatly segue into the movie review. So, instead, we will unneatly segue into the movie
review. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. The new film, The Reconstruction of William Zero, is about cloning. Not that we're supposed to know that at the beginning. The distributors are playing it cagey with their description, and they want us to think that at the start, the main character William, played in all incarnations by Connell Byrne, is being tended to by his twin brother after a car accident. Even if our first sight of the incapacitated man didn't have him hooked into some kind of virtual reality rig, the fact that we know going in that this is a science fiction slash horror film and that William is involved in some kind of high-stakes work for a powerful genetics corporation would tip director Dan Bush's hand from the get-go. I'm not blowing any big spoilers here. If I can figure it out, pretty much anyone with a fair knowledge of SF genres can. The backstory is that 4 years previous, William Blakely accidentally killed his young son in a car accident. His wife, played by Amy Simetz, has left him as a result, and he now lives alone, save for his recently spawned and still rather vulnerable copy. But a release from loneliness isn't the only reason why William has duplicated himself. There are others, one of which you can figure out without much thought, but also a few more that come as a bit of a surprise, so I won't blow them here. Cloning stories have a tendency to open up several cans of worms, both practically and morally. Not as complex as time travel stories, maybe, but the issues can still be daunting. If you commit murder, is your exact clone culpable as well? If your clone makes love to your wife and she knows about it, is it cheating? If she doesn't, is it rape? Director Bush, who co-wrote the film with his star and producing partner Byrne, folds such events into the story but doesn't seem to want to engage the more sticky moral quandaries that attach to them. In Bush's and Byrne's defense, they have other issues they want to address, and you can't do everything. But the fact that the questions still bugged me means that I wasn't particularly engaged enough in the filmmaker's concerns to abandon my own. There were several roadblocks that kept me from getting there. Connell Byrne is quite good in his various incarnations of William Blakely. I'm not sure if that name is meant to somehow reference William Blake, maybe we're looking at things from both an innocent and an experienced viewpoint, but that's where my knowledge of the poet ends, so I could be missing something there. In any case, Byrne does manage to portray distinctive personalities for each incarnation of William that still clearly draw a connection to one person, yet Byrne never really gets me to sympathize with any one of those versions, even the one you're supposed to feel empathy for. Meanwhile, Bush's sequencing of the film at times makes it feel more like we're watching a fractured timeline than two characters experiencing concurrent events. And for all the bigger themes that Bush and Byrne want to address, they keep pulling themselves back to some well-worn plot contrivances, including the big bad genetics corp with its own shadowy law unto itself security arm, and introducing a couple of poorly motivated interlopers into William's world, because there needs to be some sort of body count, doesn't there? No, there doesn't. And while these things keep the scope of the film from shrinking down to just two men in a house, they feel more like distractions. I do appreciate the reconstruction of William Zero for using the idea of cloning to tell a different kind of emotional story. And at times, the film's exploration of the persistence of guilt and the question of how far one can move beyond tragedy before a different kind of pain is inflicted can be quite affecting. Bush's and Byrne's goals for the reconstruction of William Zero are admirable. A bit more work needed to be done on the execution. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed over at mightymoviepodcast.com.
Well, the CFQ may have changed, but the .com keeps booming along. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico radio, vibrating 99.5 million times every second, or broadcasting at 99.5 FM. They mean the same thing, unless, of course, you're listening via the internet over WBAI.org, or you're listening to the download version of the show after its broadcast, in which case, welcome to the past. But it is Thursday, April 16th, which would be Margot Adler's birthday. She would be 68 today had she survived. See, I open your mic and we can hear WHCR next door. Could you point the mic a little more toward you?
Sure.
Yeah. Ooh, I like that.
All right. If you like it, sounds. I love it.
Yeah, no, it's like moving things along. I'm about to go into a whole bunch of announcements. But first, our guest this morning is Sam J. Miller, who I hope steady listeners to Hour of the Wolf have heard. This would be, what, your fourth show?
Third or fourth.
Well, you were first on with Jen Brissett.
That's correct.
Who is now, her first novel has been doing wonderfully, Elysium.
Yep.
Published by Aqueduct Press.
Philip K. Dick Award nominee.
Yeah. And James Tiptree Jr. Honorarium?
Something
like
citation,
that. Tribute,
something.
Citation, tribute. Good book, people. That's all we have to say. It's a good book. You should darn well read it.
Which I read with her at NERSIF, and she read from that as well.
That's right.
And it was phenomenal.
That's right. An early version. A pre-pub version. And
I was on in February of last year with Tempest to promote the Electric Velocipede Memorial service.
Yes, the name of which I still objected to, because why should it be a memorial? A tribute, fine.
All
but
those things.
It's not dead, John. It's not dead. You don't know what you're going to be thinking in 3 years. Or it's like, okay, I've had enough of being a librarian. I'm going back to the velocipede.
Well, then it rises from the grave, like any good speculative conceit.
Yeah, but, you know, why a memorial? It was a wonderful event, one way or the other. You know, nobody's ever asked me of the film.
No. I feel like I might have asked, but
if you did, I don't recall, but it was actually my first attempt at converting. I record all the readings that I attend in, well, it's 1080, And it's in a format that's sort of native to high-end professional Macintosh editors. But I did find a way, using a wonderful little freeware program called Handbrake,
okay,
that turns these things down into AVIs. And so I do actually have you, I brought down to a reasonable, a mere 720 high def version that comes in at a nice small file.
That sounds great.
1 hour is about 7 gigs.
Wow.
Which is why I haven't just, you know.
Sure.
posted, but I've gotten it down to 1 hour is now about 800 megs. And that's manageable. And it's still high def.
Great.
So so I did a segment of that with you and Barbara Krasnoff, as a matter of fact.
A wonderful team.
Yes, indeed. So let's see. So that was the second time, but you were on here.
I was on by myself a third time. I don't remember the circumstances.
It was not long after winning.
That's correct.
The Shirley Jackson Award. So that would have been last July was when you got the award. So it was July or August.
That sounds about right.
Of last year. And you're on here because you're on and you're doing a reading.
Pretty excited about it.
Yeah. And it's...
Come on, you can say it.
Okay, this entire season... Okay, I practically booked this entire season of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings at ReaderCon last year. And I got really PO'd because it started with a publicist getting in touch with me saying, do you want to have Walter Mosley? The answer to which is like, duh. Okay, so... So I told people, we're going to have Walter Mosley. And somebody said, who are you going to have with Walter Mosley? Are you going to have Chip Delaney? No. Have Chip sometime this season. Nora Jemison? No. And name like every black person they can think of is, no, I'm not. Okay, you want a box? I've got a box. I went across the hall and I found Paul J. Filippo. Paul J. Filippo is a guy who writes science fiction, but has written mysteries. And Walter Mosley is a mystery writer.
That's a hell of a box.
Who's written science fiction. There is a box. And I came up with a box for pretty much every single reading. People from Brooklyn, or this or that. You... And the aforementioned Chip Delaney, whose real name is Samuel R. Delaney. This is Sam Enchanted Evening.
I love it.
And
it's
that
a hell of a box.
Is
the box. The box of Sam's.
And somebody then said to me, why aren't you doing this in June, which is, you know, Gay Pride Month? It's because...
Every month is Gay Pride Month.
Why the F should I? That's not what this is about. It's about getting good people. You can't get better people than Sam J. Miller and Samuel R. It's true. I was very, very proud of that matchup.
Billing it as the two greatest gay Sams in science fiction. Which I'm terrified that there's some third gay Sam that I'm not thinking of.
Well, that Sam isn't well known enough. And most people don't think of Delaney as Sam.
Correct.
He's Chip. Although one time, many, many years ago, Chip was like my second boss here ever at WBAI in 1968. I love to tell that story, and I'll tell it next Tuesday. But... one time I had him on Hour of the Wolf when we were on during the Hour of the Wolf, 5 to 7 a.m., and Jeff Greenfield, now of CBS and Channel 13 and various, he's a big deal commentator and used to be best known as a satirist, would follow me at 7 a.m., and he walks into the room and he sees Delaney and he says, Sammy! Sammy?
Who Who is this man?
Bronx High School of Science.
Wow.
They like shared a desk or something. But Sammy?
So to high school classmates, perhaps.
They were high school classmates? Yeah, exactly.
But to the world at large.
But Chip, he doesn't blink twice at being called any name that is part of his proper name. Delaney, okay, so let's do the... we've got three readings in a row. Maybe I should do them in reverse order, thereby ending up with you, and then we can do the show.
Great.
Reverse order. We're usually the first Tuesday of every month. The reason, by the way, why we're going on April 21st was in deference to Sammy, so that he wouldn't have conflict at Temple University where he teaches. See, the semester or whatever it is over at that point, and he's back in New York, and it doesn't trouble him because he usually has a class on Wednesday mornings at like 8 a.m. So, no, it doesn't work. But, okay, so our first Tuesday of next month will be May 5th, Cinco de Mayo. We're having nothing to do with that. I have been trying to corral one of the curators of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings for quite a while, and it's very hard to get her out of Memphis, where she lives, or, where is it in Massachusetts that she teaches? It's not Smith College, or is it Smith College? In Northampton. With Andrea Hairston and Pan Morrigan. Good people to work with. Cherie Renee Thomas.
Amazing.
Who was on this show a couple of months ago when her world-changing book, Dark Matter, came out in ebook format after all these years. It was a 2000 book. It was a notable New York Times book, blah, 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 blah. And she ran the reading series for 2 years, which were eye-openers for me because I met all these people, some of whom I'm close friends now, including Terrence Taylor, who I'm pretty good friends with at this point and is a regular on this show. Our guest next week will be making her debut on this program, Celeste Rita Baker, who has a collection of short stories coming out from, Aqueduct Press. And she's a wonderful writer and reader, and she'll be making her radio debut, or at least her WBAI debut.
How exciting.
Next week. So Cherie introduced the world to a great many black writers, writers of the African diaspora, which is the way that she puts it, which is actually a language that I like a lot. It really, you know, it's not African American, it's not this, it's wherever you are in the world, your origins were from Africa. Quite astonishing. And with her, N.K. Jemisin, Nora Jemisin. I don't think Nora has yet written a book that she hasn't been nominated for a top honor for.
I think you actually cannot do better than that.
Yeah.
In terms of guests.
Well, yeah, exactly. She hasn't won yet, but she has short stories, novels. Nora is one of the best. Regular listeners will have heard her. Better yet, come to 388 Atlantic Avenue on May 5th. Doors open at 6:30. Admission is free. Donations accepted. Working backwards, 1 week, April 28th. Robert Shearman. Okay, I didn't come up with this. Ellen Datlow has put this book in some of the best of the year's horror and stuff like that. He writes really good short stories. I take a look. Where has he published? Lightspeed Magazine. Boing. I do podcasts for, I edit, that is audio edit, the podcasts, and I host them for Lightspeed Magazine, and there he all of a sudden inundated. But what sells me? He wrote the episode Dalek, episode number 5 of the newly reborn at that time Doctor Who in 2005. That's a great episode with Chris Eccleston. And before that, he was writing Doctor Who novels and the radio series that was at first unofficial and then became official. And he's a very good playwright. And he's got a play opening in New York, which is why he's coming in from London. So that got sandwiched in. And now, finally, this coming Tuesday, Samuel R. Delaney, this year still, grand until he has to hand over the tiara I think they've already named the new Grandmaster from the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. I forget who it is, but for right now and for all times, because once a Grandmaster, always a Grandmaster.
Sort of like how you're always Mr. President, even after you've left office.
Exactly. But at this moment, he is the most recently crowned, and at about time, in his 70s, Grandmaster of Science Fiction, and just one of the most superb writers out there. If you like old style SF, read Babel 17. If you like new wave science fiction, read The Einstein Intersection.
And if you like a total head trip, bizarre, amazing, earth shaking experience, read Dahlgren.
A book that some important critics compare to Pynchon.
Absolutely.
And deservedly so.
Sure.
Ulysses. Delaney will be studied in 100 years, in 200 years. His work is that important. And
Times Square Red, Times Square Blue.
Oh, God, no, great, Chip, no.
One of the all-time great.
He does an Yursif reading some years back. I don't remember who the curator was. And he's reading from Times Square Red, Times Square Blue about getting himself, shall we say, serviced in a grindhouse, you know, 42nd Street. That means movie theater, but in this case, it also means the other.
It's about 40% of the book.
Yeah. And, you know, how useful it was that this unknown person was able to remove their dentures in order to give Chip greater pleasure. And he's reading this out loud with the 6-year-old and 8-year-old in the audience just looking up totally enrapt, going, what's he talking about? But their parents were cool with it. So I thought, okay. But it's like, Chip, look at the audience.
It's one of the truly great texts of New York City urban planning and history. And
it really, at the time the book came out, I'm going, okay, Chip, you're going to talk about that on my show. Fine. We'll broadcast it. You'll read it. You'll do it. Yes, because you are who you are, and this is an important... Today, I consider that book an important landmark. And I think that he knew it at the time because he saw it. The book was about the changing, and we didn't know it was going to go, God help us, all Disney.
No, it's true. It's in the book. He talks about Disney. And the Disney store was like the flagship.
It had just, but I don't think that even he foresaw just how Disneyfied the whole thing would be.
Right.
What he didn't write about was there was a transition period when it went from being the seamy place to becoming Disney, New York, Disney Times Square. Some department of New York took it over and turned it into an event space. So it was a Peepland place where you could go in, and if you looked in different booths, you could see movies by William Wegman. Now, if you don't know who William Wegman does, these wonderful photographs and movies with his dogs. All family friendly, we should mention. Not only family friendly, family musts.
Right.
There were people in windows posing as mannequins in former sex shops and stuff like that. It was performance art. They had turned the entire block. And that was actually, you know, between Times Square Red and Times Square Blue, there was Times Square, we shouldn't say purple.
WTF.
And with Delaney reading this coming Tuesday, April 21st, Doors open at 6:30. Event begins 7-ish. Will be Sam J. Miller, who is here with me.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, finally. Oh, my God. It's 2 p.m. Boy, well, I started 2 minutes late. But, hi there.
Hi. How's it going?
Apparently okay. I'm talking my mouth off, and you've gotten 2 sentences in.
They've been great sentences, though, so I'm perfectly comfortable.
Yeah, but you had to bring up Times Square Red, Times Square Blue, and that just set me off.
I apologize.
Yeah, but it was worth saying.
Absolutely.
At any rate, and brought back images of wonderful readings that Delaney has done for the series. When you were first on this show, with Jen Brissett, I believe she was unpublished and you'd sold maybe 1 story?
I don't even think I had sold that.
Yeah.
I had just graduated from Clarion, and I was organizing a LGBTQ reading at Blue Stockings that I was promoting. And so Jen was promoting her
Kindred reading series,
and I was promoting my event. So
that was the glue
that's
for
correct.
Both of them, were readings, other reading series in New York that weren't just KGB or the Fantastic Fiction series or the NYRSF reading series. That was the glue.
That's right.
And you each had fiction to read, and
since then we've had a few things, you know, out in the world.
Yeah. So 2 of your stories, both of which went through the editorship of John Joseph Adams, but also were performed as podcasts, which I got to edit and in one case host. The first one being 57 Reasons for the Slate Quarry Suicides. Did I get the title?
You got it. You got it 100% right.
Okay, very good. Why the number 57? I never did get to ask that.
You know, I'm not really sure. It's a number.
It's not a Heinz thing, right?
No, it is not. I did, someone asked me that question. I did jokingly say, because it's secretly about ketchup. But I don't think they got it. I think the number 57 has always...
And at the end, it is. Ketchup
after,
and water.
After a fashion.
Yeah, and we're not going to say more than that,
right,
because that would be spoilers.
The number 57 sort of recurs in my life. I don't know why. It just seems to be, like, if not a lucky number, a recurrent number. And I didn't go into it thinking this was going to be 57 reasons. I just wanted it to be a list story of reasons. And 57 was where it ended up. And as I was approaching 57, I was like, okay, I need this to be 57 for reasons that have nothing to do with anything but my own.
So the story was just listing, as it were.
That's right.
And that was the number that you chose to...
That's right. So that sort of helped me condense some and eliminate others and try to keep it to 57, because the number was resonant for me, and hopefully that whatever I'm tapping into would be resonant in the story itself.
Yeah. And that story deservedly won the Shirley Jackson Award for Best Horror Short Story.
It did.
And I saw an interview with you that I wanted to steal a question from. Not that I would ever do that. But the lead character, he's not exactly a protagonist, is he? He's not the good guy. Well, I mean, that's obvious. Although there are stories in which somebody does dastardly things, and they are the good guy.
Right. Right. No, I think of Jared in that story as someone who doesn't know that they're a villain, somebody whose actions make sense to themselves but doesn't quite understand how
he
they're
even
hurting.
Says, like, early on in the story, he cites Carrie,
right,
and Stephen King Carrie, and that there is a parallel there.
Sure. Sure. But I wanted to do, I mean, for me, one of the things that excites me about science fiction and fantasy and the genre as a whole is the ability to use a speculative lens to look at a real thing. And so the story is at least in part a story about privilege and about the privilege that he has that sort of blinds him to the way other people inhabit the world. And so his privilege as a white person is mirrored in his sort of supernatural ability that he has, and this ability he has that he thinks of as a force for good and that other people might see as a force for horror. So you know, one of the things I love about The Great Gatsby is the fact that I personally think that the narrator is the villain of the piece, and that the narrator never realizes it. And so I was kind of going for a similar thing of a villain.
I think I haven't yet seen the DiCaprio version of that, but I think that he probably had that sense. Don't know about Baz Luhrmann, but I think DiCaprio, I think he likes those roles.
Yeah.
Whether it's Howard Hughes or the Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah. No, but that movie was okay. He did indeed play a sort of villainous tint to Gatsby, but Nick Carraway, the narrator, I think, is the villain in that that Nick believes that he's just a passive observer, but he's actually sort of, he is condoning certain activities and censoring others in ways that I think have a pretty villainous ultimate impact.
Yeah.
Like he observes numerous incidents of domestic violence against women that he doesn't say anything about.
That's true. I've never read the book, I have to admit.
That's a quick read.
Yeah. I'll get around to it. But for me, the most important thing was, I roll my eyes at Baz Luhrmann because that's what you're supposed to do.
Correct.
But Carey Mulligan, yeah.
Yes.
Ever since she was on Doctor Who, Sally Sparrow, she will always to me be Sally Sparrow from Blink.
Well, she made a marvelous Daisy, so...
Yeah, well, she's been a marvelous whatever. She's on Broadway right now, and
what's she in?
Oh, it's a David Hare show, starring with, and I've never been sure how to pronounce his name, Bill Nighy, Nighy, brilliant actor,
right.
Where they are a couple,
fascinating,
and, you know, and what 40 years apart. Kind of thing, 35 to 40 years apart, and therein lies the crux of it. There are problems with the play because David Hare always, no matter what, he's got to bring in villainy from British politics. No matter what it is he's writing about, it can't just be the human condition. And that was, other things I've seen by David Hare have had that issue.
Got it.
And after 57 Reasons, the next thing, not long after I took on the mantle of being the host, not just the podcast editor, again, I always have to say I'm not the editor. I don't choose the stories. I'm the audio editor. I cut it up. Actually, post-production is the term that they use now, but since I learned on tape machines with razor blades and tape, you know, splicing tape.
When editing was editing.
When editing was editing, and you had the scars to prove it. So I think of myself as the editor, but with a podcast, when Stefan Rudnicki chooses the stories and John Joseph Adams is the editor of Lightspeed Magazine, as well as Nightmare Magazine, which is where 57 Reasons showed up.
Both marvelous outlets.
Yeah, and both, by the way, are still online. You can read the story through either venue, and you can also hear those podcasts. But then came a story called We Are the Cloud. And that was another amazing story.
Thank you.
Which I think also had some glue to 57 Reasons. There is a certain, it's more cyber-based. It also had a similar theme about a person who was able to use not so much paranormal. Would you consider that story science fiction?
I would consider We Are the Cloud science fiction.
Yeah, that's what. Would I. Because the first story, the power comes from supernatural.
Right.
And the second story, it's still a power.
Right, it's a port in the back of his head beaming a wireless signal.
Yeah, exactly. It's a Wi-Fi.
Right.
And
Wi-Fi, sci-fi.
Yeah, well, Wi-Fi, sci-fi. it's, again, a powerful, well-done story.
Thank you.
And but I could actually see, this is the imprimatur of the current mode of Sam J. Miller's writing.
That's fair enough. That's fair enough. I had actually been working on We Are the Clouds since 2008. I first started submitting it for publication in 2008, and it didn't get accepted until John accepted it in 2013, 2014.
Yeah, and let that be a lesson to people, because there are, you know, people submit things, and then they don't get accepted, and they stop submitting it, and no, there are too many good venues.
Nope, and this was never in the trunk. It was never, let me sit on this for a while. It was always out there somewhere,
yeah,
as I was going through numerous revisions. So it's one of the things that I'm most proud of. I was really happy with it in a lot of ways, and, you know, Lightspeed does such phenomenal work, and I was so excited that it found a home there.
Yeah, and then it got blessed with a nomination for a Nebula Award from the, again, aforementioned Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, which is unlike the Hugos, which is a popularity award voted on by anybody who pays the price for voting. This is a peer award.
That's right. It's given you. It's the people who nominate and the people who vote are members of CIFWA. So they are writers and other professionals in the field.
Yeah, I'm an associate member, so I'm allowed to nominate, but I'm not allowed to vote, which seems fair.
Fair enough.
Because I'm not a writer. I was once, but that was so far back and so weird a thing where Jim Bain. I was a reader at Galaxy Magazine, and Spider Robinson was working there. And it was like, oh, yeah, they didn't sell ad space. We need another 750 words.
Wow.
Spider, you write something. I write something for you all the time. Jim, you write it. I'm not a writer. So Spider said, okay, write this down. It was a dark and stormy night.
You can't go wrong.
And it got published under the name B.D. Wyatt. And I did three stories, which is good enough.
There you go.
For
why B.D. Wyatt? Was that your choice, or was that...
No, that was a house name.
Got it.
It was
like Alan Smithy?
Well, it's a pun.
Oh.
This is a pseudonym that was used by George Alec Effinger and by, I believe, both Joe and Jay Haldeman at one time or another, and certainly by Spider Robinson. But no, just reverse the initials. Why did he buy it?
That's excellent.
That was a Jim Bain thing at near the penultimate form of Galaxy Magazine.
Got it.
So, but the Nebula Award to me, I guess the World Fantasy Award is also a high crowning achievement, but that is, and like the Shirley Jackson Award, which is for horror, these are juried awards. So there are, what, five people, I think, for the Jackson?
I believe so. I'm not sure.
And I think it's also five people for the World Fantasy Award. And I always thought that their identities were kept secret, except then I just read who the next...
Unless you go to the website.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So actually, it is known.
Yeah, it was at least for the Shirley Jackson Awards, which made for some awkward moments at ReaderCon when I was chatting up a judge who I knew the answer to whether or not my story had won the award, and had to, you know, all of whom were marvelously diplomatic. And
I had a horrible year at Nebula Awards where I was interviewing everybody nominated that year, and I knew.
Ugh.
I knew 2 days before.
The Cassandra complex, the horrible pain of foreknowledge.
And a lot of these people are friends.
Sure.
And you're sitting there, and it's just like, Tilly, I know you're going to win. I can't tell you.
Right.
I
know you're not going to win. And
yeah,
can't tell and you that either.
I'm not naming those people.
Sure. Sure, sure.
But I knew, and my, oh God, my heart was breaking.
Yeah. No, well, I mean, it is such a huge honor to be nominated for a Nebula Award, and I'm super excited, and I'm going to go to the Nebula weekend and enjoy the hell
out of it. In Chicago
this year. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Enjoy the hell out of it until the moment when I find out that I didn't, in fact, win. Well, you know, maybe
I
will.
Which is the attitude you have to go in with.
That's right. That's right.
But this—that is, I mean, the Hugos are another thing, especially this year, and we're not getting into
that's a separate episode or six.
I have always said, and people listen to my show, I have always said, the Hugos are the People's Choice Awards.
That's right.
Of science fiction, which isn't in and of itself a bad thing, but it's simply you pay your $40, you get to vote.
That's right.
And that's the only criteria.
That's right.
The Nebula Awards, the Saturn. Not the Saturn, because that's like media. But the world fantasy, for me, the crowning achievement is the Nebula Award, because it is your peers. It's the other writers.
That's right. And unlike the, if you look, I mean, that's really borne out, you know, shenanigans with the Hugos aside, it's really borne out by, if you look at the nominees this year. And
we just have to explain to listeners, because very, very few of them know, there were people of a religious and or right-wing or libertarian nature who nominated slates of people and got people to vote on the nominees for the Hugo Awards. And so many of them got in that there are entire categories that are practically like forced in from this popular ballot, so that people are saying, I'm sorry, I'm so proud to have been nominated, but I'm withdrawing my nomination.
That's right. And there are several people on the ballot who are open white supremacists and openly homophobic, and are on the record with tons of extremely anti-feminist and anti-people of color perspectives, and who really sort of rallied a lot of popular resentment against feminists and against the sort of incredible gains.
And what they're saying is they want the old style of science fiction, which is, yeah, if you want the politics of H.P. Lovecraft, you know.
Right. You are not alone.
Yeah, exactly. But, and this leads into, I mean, we can go on and on and on, and the science fiction world, not only the science fiction world, this has appeared in major media, including Atlantic Monthly and Slate Magazine.
That's right.
The Guardian, the Manchester Guardian, right, from England. It's a big deal.
It's a big deal. But, you know, aside from that and the fact that the Hugos, as you say, are a whole separate can of worms, the Nebulas themselves are an incredible lineup and reflect so much of the great, great stuff that's happening, and so many of the writers that I find super exciting, you know, like Ken Liu and Alyssa Wong and Usman Malik, and so many really great writers who are coming from tons of places that I think make the kind of the folks who are calling themselves sad puppies a little nervous and upset. Because these are writers who are writers of color and women and LGBTQ writers.
But I was going to ask a simpler question going back before, or maybe I should save it for after the story. But now we're talking about the awards now, so let me bring the question up now. Forgetting all of the controversy of this year, would these stories that you have written, would they have been nominated 10 years ago? Or 15 years ago?
I don't know. It's a really good question. I'm not super able to answer it because I wasn't, you know, in the genre then. Wasn't submitting. Wasn't writing really.
I can say I remember very well, because this show was on in 1973 when Dahlgren came out.
Right.
That Lester Del Rey had conniptions, not homophobic conniptions, science fiction conniptions. Dahlgren is not science fiction, saith he.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing, is that there's always been, I mean, there's nothing that I, you know, We Are the Cloud got some really harsh reviews, in large part because there's a lot of gay sex in it. And I think that there's not a lot that I'm doing here that wasn't done by Sam Delaney 30 years ago.
Yeah, there was one comment on the Lightspeed podcast, as a matter of fact, that I thought was actually an interesting comment, which was, if you are having overt gay sex, graphic gay sex in the story, could you just label that before I give it to my 8-year-old?
Right.
And that I thought was a legitimate concern, but also it's a two-edged sword because spoilers.
I mean, I'm not a parent. I couldn't speak for what it's like to be a parent. I wouldn't give my 8-year-old child something I hadn't read and didn't know whether or not it was acceptable for them.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
but
you see, what you do is you give your 8-year-old a smartphone or an iPad or something like that, and you fix it up with iTunes and you say, check out this podcast. It's a lot of fun. And bingo, in there comes something that might be of an adult. I'm not going to say gay or whatever, just an adult nature.
Sure.
Sure, I thought it was an interesting point.
Absolutely.
I'm not commenting beyond that.
Sure, sure. No, I mean, I think that...
That's all diversion from my actual question.
Yeah, and I don't have an answer. I think that there's a ton of amazing stuff happening now, and a lot of it is stuff that maybe wasn't happening 15 years ago, and then that could be for a lot of reasons. And to me, I think what's exciting is how many outlets there are, like Lightspeed and Clark's World and Shimmer and Apex and Strange Horizons that are really...
And Apex and Abyss.
To
get confusing.
That's right.
They're both good publications.
That's right. And that are publishing so much exciting stuff, so many fresh voices, so many new folks who, you know, many of whom had been in the science fiction community forever, but weren't necessarily, you know, finding places that were welcoming of their stuff. So while I think that, like I said, there's nothing here that Sam Delaney wasn't doing better and more edgy, more provocatively 30 years ago, I think that the genre as a whole is super welcoming of so many things that didn't have a ton of places to live 30 years ago.
Yeah, 20 years ago. Oh, when was it? 30 years ago, Delaney and I were doing a radio version of one of the appendices of Tales of Neverian, which was, what was it called? Plague of Carnivals. Long, long Delaney-like title, you know, 18 words long. It was basically about AIDS. And I'm not sure if it was spec fic or not. I don't care.
I don't care either. I've gotten a ton of reviews lately that have been taking me to task for being insufficiently speculative. And I've also read a lot of reviews of stories that I absolutely adored that were not by me, that were finding them wanting because it wasn't science fiction enough. And I'm never really sure what people want those stories to be and what science fiction means to them that's so narrow that if it doesn't have, I don't know, sentient gas clouds and AI, it suddenly is not science fiction.
There was a time when this radio program, and this time was probably the 70s, was very, very concerned with what might be today considered, shall we say, masturbatory thinking over the definitions of, is this science fiction or is it fantasy? And now, you know, everybody falls back to speculative fiction, which they think is a new term, which in fact was coined by Robert Heinlein in 1946.
Well, how about that?
Yeah, how about that? for people who think that that's like... And then now we have interstitial, we have slipstream, but the best definition of science fiction of all time is from Damon Knight, founder of Science Fiction Writers of America, who said, science fiction is what I'm pointing at.
There you go. It's like the Supreme Court definition of pornography. I know it when I see it.
Yeah, pretty much. Actually, he went a bit further. But the Supreme Court definition, in theory, cannot be broadcast. But
Fair enough.
No, it isn't fair enough. Okay.
I think that's what's so exciting about the genre is there so much diversity of what the genre is and what's science fiction and what's fantasy and what's horror, and that's right down to like the difference of like what a writer thinks. I didn't think 57 Reasons for the Slate Quarry Suicides was horror, but John Joseph Adams did, and he published it as such, and it won an award.
He published it as science fiction. It was in Lightspeed. No, it was not in Nightmare.
It was in
Nightmare. 57 is horror. Yeah. Sometimes I'm editing them and I'm not sure.
A blur of wonderfulness.
It's like every bleeping story this month was apocalyptic. I mean, and which is which?
People like apocalyptic. I don't. particularly.
Datlow has a really good apocalypse book out this month, and John just came out with Wastelands 2, on which I worked on the entire audiobook. Oh, God, 30-plus stories. Good stories, but, I mean, it's like, can we have a grin somewhere?
Yeah, yeah.
But some of them were amazing. The Juno Diaz. Oh, God. Anyway. We Are the Cloud. I understand you have a edited version of this that you did for the conference in Florida. What's the name of that?
ICFA, which if you asked me to say what ICFA stands for, I would give you my most winning smile.
International Conference
on the Fantastic in the Arts. Something like that.
I think that's it. I've never gone. It sounds wonderful.
It was a phenomenal con, and I'm not just saying that because it was in Florida, and I got to take a break from 20-degree days to be in an 80-degree day. But it was a great con, and I was really excited to have a reading with Genevieve Valentine and Either Lee Yu and Fran Wilde, and it was phenomenal.
Yeah,
and
I have to open the door because Lister, for once, is here. Thank God you're here, man. Yeah, really.
So I had this reading at ICFA, and I did a special shortened version of We Are the Cloud, which We Are the Cloud is a novelette. It's quite long. The audio recording on Lightspeed that you produced was 40-something minutes.
Yeah, that's actually not that, but that's average for a lot of our podcasts.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a short novelette, but a novelette nonetheless. So this is my attempt to...
Define for me, because I'm always forgetting, the difference between a short story, novelette, novella, and novel.
Sure. I'm probably going to get it wrong myself, because I'm quite bad at these definitions. At these genre delineations. But it is indeed word count. I believe that 0 to 7,500 words is a short story. 7,500 to 13,000 is a novelette. 13,000 to, I think, 40,000 is a novella, and upwards of that is a novel. Yes.
Yeah.
I could be wrong about the precise amounts, but it's you know, I think of it like a novelette is a long story, and a novella is a short novel.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. Yeah, well, next week's podcast is very short. The one after that is like...
Get comfortable.
It's over 90 minutes.
Wow.
The recording I got is over 2 hours.
Wow.
And I get to cut it down. So it's going to
be about
90 minutes.
Sure.
Yeah, but it's good reading. And it's a good story. By one of the people, I forget her name immediately, Billette. I have not read her stuff yet. She just pulled out of the Hugos.
Uh-huh. I just saw that bit a bunch
of... Yeah, she was nominated and withdrew her nomination.
Wow.
It's sad.
It is. It's really sad. It is, but I certainly understand folks who are pretty upset.
We're going to have to do a show on this in the future, maybe after the awards, after the dust has settled.
That's right.
But there's a huge question about a lot more than the sanctity of a Fannish award.
Exactly right. Yeah,
that's all about, what was the term they used in Atlantic? Loose democracy.
Right.
The downfalls of a loose democracy.
That's right.
I'd love to hear that story. I'd love to hear your rendition of it.
Fair enough.
Is there anything we need to warn people?
No,
it's of an adult nature.
It's of an adult nature. I've tried to calm down the curse words and scale back the intercourse.
Yes, literally.
So I've also tried to make it streamlined enough to read it in its entirety. So there are some scenes that are dramatically cut down and some that are cut altogether. So while
it's not Baudelaireized.
It's not Baudelaireized, but it's a complete arc. So it's not going to leave people wanting more in the sense of they're wondering what happens. But
well,
hopefully,
maybe some of the characters. Well, but that's another.
Fair enough. Tell me when.
When?
All right.
Just, but first, as I always have to say, I need to remind people that this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. My guest is Sam J. Miller. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And after the reading, I will have come up with a piece of music, and we will return after that. So now you have the mic. Oh, and... is it okay if I, you know, like, Instagram you during the...
Please do.
Okay, I please will do that.
I'm a sucker for getting my picture taken.
Okay. And your hair color is different every single time you're on the show.
I try to do it once a year, so this year is blue.
Okay.
It is my blue period.
It's like Picasso.
just like Picasso.
Yeah.
All right, so I'll get started. This is We Are the Cloud. Me and Case met when someone slammed his head against my door, so hard I heard it with my earphones in and my Game Boy cranked up loud. Sad music from Mega Man 2 filled my head, and then there was this thud like the world stopped spinning for a second. I opened my door. Some skinny thug had a bloody-faced kid by the shirt. What? I said, and then what? And then what the? And then, finally, hell. I barked the last word, tightening all my muscles at once. Damn, man, the thug said, startled. He hollered down the stairs. Goddamn Goliath over here can talk. He let go of the kid's shirt and was gone. 30 boys live at Egan House, foster kids awaiting placement that would never come. I looked at the kid he'd been messing with. A line of blood cut his face more or less down the middle, but the gash in his forehead was pretty small. His eyes were huge and clear in the middle of all that blood. He looked like something I'd seen before in an ad or movie or dream. Thanks, dude, the kid said. He ran his hand down his face and then planted it on the outside of my door. I nodded. Mostly when I open my mouth to say something, the words get all twisted on the way out, or the wrong words sneak in, which is why I tend to not open my mouth. Once he was gone, I sniffed at the big bloody handprint. My cloud port hurt from wanting him. Suddenly, it didn't quite fit right, atop the tiny hole where a fiber optic wire threaded into my brainstem through the joint where skull met spine. Desire was dangerous, something I fought hard to keep down, but the moment I met Case, I knew I would lose. Egan House was my 12th group home. I had never seen a kid with blue eyes in any of them. I had always assumed they had no place in foster care, that there was some other, better system set up to receive them. I had been at Egan House 6 months the week that Case came. I was inches away from turning 18 and aging out. Nothing was waiting for me. I spent an awful lot of energy not thinking about it. Better to sit tight for the little time I had left, in a room barely wider than its bed, relying on my size to keep people from messing with me. At night, unable to sleep, trying hard to think of anything but the future, I'd focus on the sounds of boys trying not to make noise as they cried or jerked off. On Tuesday, the day after the bloody-faced boy left his handprint on my door, he came and knocked. I'd been looking out my window. Not everyone had one. Mine faced south, showed me a wide sweep of the Bronx. Looking out, I could imagine myself as a signal sent out over the municipal Wi-Fi, beamed across the city, cut loose from this body and its need to be fed and sheltered and cared about, its need for other bodies. I could see things sometimes, things I knew I shouldn't be seeing, hints of images beamed through the wireless node that my brain had become. Hey, the kid said, knocking again, and I knew from how I felt when I heard his voice how doomed I was. Angel Quinones, he said, when I opened the door, nicknamed Sauro because you look like a big old brontosaurus. Actually, my mom called me Sauro because I like dinosaurs, but it was close enough. Okay, I said. I stepped inside and in he came. Case, my name's Case. Do you want me to continue with the dossier I've collected on you? When I didn't do anything but stare, he said, silence is consent. A smile forced its way across my face, terrifying me. He reached out to rub the top of my head. You're a mystery man, Sauro. What crazy stuff have you got going on in there? I shrugged, bit back the cat urge to push my head into his hand, ignored the cloud port itch flaring up fast and sharp. The sun at some point had gotten lost behind a ragged row of tenements. Case said, something else they said. You're going to age out at any minute now. Yeah, that must be scary. I grunted. They say most guys leaving foster care end up on the street. Most. The street, the words like knives driven under all my toenails at once, the stories I had heard, men frozen to death under expressways, men set on fire by frat boys. You got a plan? No plan. Well, stick with me, kid, Case said in fluent fake movie gangster. I got a plan big enough for both of us. Do you smoke? He asked, flicking out two. I didn't, but I took the cigarette. His fingers touched mine. I wanted to say it isn't allowed in here, but Case's smile was a higher law. What's a decent pork chop around here? I heard the Bronx ones were all unhygienic as hell. Riverdale, I said. That's the one I go to. Nice office. No one waiting outside to jump you. The telecoms had paid for New York's municipal wireless grid, installing thousands of routers across all five boroughs. Rich people loved having free wireless everywhere, but it wasn't a public service. Companies did it because the technology had come around to where you could use the human brain for data processing, so they could wave money in the faces of hard-up people and say, "Let us put this tiny wire into your brain and plug that into the wireless signal and exploit a portion of your brain's underutilized capacity, turning you into one node in a massively distributed data processing center." It worked, of course. Any business model based around poor people making bad decisions out of ignorance and desperation always works. Just ask McDonald's or the heroin dealer who used to sell to my mom. "I need to establish a new primary," Case said. "We'll go tomorrow." He smiled so I could see it wasn't a command so much as a decision he was making for both of us. "We are the cloud," said the sign on the door atop a sea of multicolored dots with stylized wireless signals bouncing between them. Walking in with Case, I saw that maybe I had oversold the place by saying it was nice. Nicer than the ones by Lincoln Hospital, maybe, where people came covered in blood and puke, having left against medical advice after spasming out in a public housing stairwell. But still, it wasn't actually nice. Older people nodded off on benches, smelling of hunger. Gross as it was, I liked those offices. All those ports started a pleasant buzzing in my head, like we added up to something. "Look at that guy," Case said, sitting down on the bench beside me. He pointed to a man whose head was tilted back, gurgling up a steady stream of phlegm that had soaked his shirt and was dripping onto the floor. "Overclocked," I said, and stopped. His shoulder felt good against my bicep. Some people sell more than they should of their brain. Sell enough of it and they'd put you up in one of their node care facilities, grim nursing homes for 20-something vegetables and doddering senior citizens in their 30s. But once you were in, you were never coming out, because people ported that hard could barely walk a block or speak a sentence, let alone obtain and hold meaningful employment. And if I didn't want to end up on the street, that was my only real option. I'd been to job interviews. Some I walked into on my own, some the system set up for me. Nothing was out there for anyone, let alone a frowning, stammering tower of man who more than one authority figure had referred to as a goddamn imbecile. "What about him?" Case asked, pointing to another guy whose legs and hands twitched too rhythmically and regularly for it to be a dream. "Cloud diving," I said. He laughed. "I thought only retards could do that. That's..." I said, "not..." "Okay," he said, when he saw I wouldn't be saying anything else on the subject. I wanted very badly to cry. A part of me had thought maybe I could share it with Case, tell him what I could do, but of course I couldn't. I fast-blinked, each brief shutting of my eyes showing a flurry of cloud-snatched photographs. 10 minutes later, I caught him smiling at me, maybe realizing he had said something wrong. I wanted so badly for Case to see inside my head what I was, how I wasn't an imbecile. Our eyes locked. I leaned forward, hungry for him to see me the way no one else ever had. I wanted to tell him what I could do, how I could access data, how sometimes I thought I could maybe control data, how I dreamed of using it to burn everything down. But I wasn't strong enough to think those things, let alone say them. Some secrets you can't share, no matter how badly you want to. Eyes shut, back at Egan House, I let myself melt into data. Shuffled faster and faster, pulled back far enough to see Manhattan looming huge and epic with mountains of data at Wall Street and Midtown. Saw the Bronx, a flat spread of tiny data heaps here and there. I held my breath seeing it, feeling certain no one had ever seen it like this before. Money and megabytes in massive spiraling loops, unspeakably gorgeous and fragile. I could see how much money would be lost if the flow was broken for even a single second, and I could see where all the fault lines lay. But I wasn't looking for that. I was looking for Case. And then... Case came knocking, like I had summoned him up from the data stream, like what I wanted actually mattered outside of my head. "Hey there, mister," he said when I opened my door. I took a few steps backwards. Later, he whispered, "You ever do this before? With a guy?" "Not out loud. I mean, not in real life." "You've thought about it?" "Yeah." "You've thought about it a lot?" "Yeah." His mouth was moving down my belly, his body pinning me to the bed, which was good because God had turned off gravity and the slightest breeze would have had me floating right out the window and into space. I fought sleep as hard and long as I could. I didn't want to not be there. And when I knew I couldn't fight it anymore, I let myself sink into data, easy as blinking this time, felt myself ebb out my cloud port. But instead of following the random data beamed into me by the nearest router, I reached, felt my way across the endless black gulf of 6 inches that separated his cloud port from mine, and found him there, a jagged, wobbly galaxy of data, ugly and incongruous, but beautiful because it was him, and because, even if it was only for a moment, he was mine. Case, I said. He twitched in his sleep. Said his own name. I love you, I said. Asleep, Case said it too. When I first came to the city, I did some porn, Case said, in the morning. I got like $500 for it. I shut my eyes, tried not to breathe, tried to stop time. I thought about what I had done while cloud diving, how I said his name and he echoed me. I dreamed of taking him up to the roof at night, snapping my fingers and making the whole Bronx go dark, except for Case's name, spelled out in blazing tenement window lights. It would be easy. I could do anything. Because Case. Would you be interested in doing something like that? No. Not even for like $1 million? Maybe $1 million, but probably not. You're funny, you know that? How you follow the rules, when all they ever do is get you hurt? Where I'm from, Case said, the next day, between bouts, you could put a down payment on a house with $2,000. Oh. You ever dream about escaping New York? Kind of, in my head. Case laughed. As opposed to what? Dreaming outside your head? What about you and me getting out of town, moving away? My head hurt with how badly I wanted that. His fingers drummed up and down my chest, ran circles around my nipples. I called that guy I know, the porn producer, told him about you. He said he'd give us each $500 and another $250 for me as a finder's fee. You called him? About me? This could be it, Sauro, a new start for both of us. I don't know, I said, but I did know. I knew I was lost, that I couldn't say no, that his mouth, now circling my belly button, had only to speak and I would act. Are you really such a proper little gentleman? He asked, his hands, cold as winter, hooked behind my knees. You never got into trouble before? My one time in trouble. I'm 5. It's 3 in the morning. I'm riding my tricycle down the block. A policeman stops me. Where's your mother? She's home. Why aren't you home? I was hungry. There's no food. Mama's on a Chiron holiday, lying on the couch while she's somewhere else. For a week I've been stealing food from corner stores. So much cigarette smoke fills the cop car, I can't breathe. At the precinct he leaves me there, windows all rolled up. Later he takes me home, talks to my mom, fills out a report, takes her away. Someone else takes me. Everything ends. All of this is punishment for some crime I committed without realizing it. I resolve right then and there to never again steal food, ride tricycles, talk to cops, think bad thoughts, step outside to get something I need. A cinder block room dressed up like how Hollywood imagines the projects. Low ceilings and Snoop Dogg posters, overflowing ashtrays, a pit bull dozing in a corner, a scared little boy sitting on the couch. I'm sorry, Rico, you know I am. You gotta give me another chance. The dark, scary drug dealer towers over him. I am the drug dealer, wearing a wife beater and a bicycle chain around his neck. That's the last time I lose money on you, punk. The drug dealer grabs the punk by the neck, rubs his thumb along his lips, pushes his thumb into the warm, wet mouth. Damn, dude, Case said while they switched to the next camera setup. You're actually kind of a good actor with how you deliver those lines. He was naked. He was fearless. I cowered on the couch, a towel covering as much of me as I could manage. What was it in Case that made him so certain nothing bad would happen to him? At first I chalked it up to white skin, but now I wasn't sure it was so simple. His eyes were on the window. His mind was already elsewhere. Would you mind heading up to the house ahead of me, he said, in the shower, after? I need some time to get my head together. I'll square up things with the director and be there soon. Waiting is cool. No, it's not. I need some alone time. Alone time, I smirk. You need to get the hell back, Angel, okay? Hearing the hardness in his voice, I wondered if there was a way to spontaneously stop being alive. When the train came above ground after 149th Street, I felt the old shudder as my cloud port clicked back into the municipal grid. Shame and anger made me brave, and I dove. I could see the car as data, saw transmissions to and from a couple dozen cell phones and tablets and bio devices, saw how the train's forward momentum warped the information flowing in and out, saw 10 jagged blobs inside, my fellow cloudbounds. Reached out again, like I had with Case. Felt myself slip through one after another like a thread through 10 needles. Tugged that thread the tiniest bit and watched all 10 bow their heads as one. Friday night, I stayed up till 3 in the morning waiting for Case to come knocking. I played the Skull Man level on Mega Man 2 until I could beat it without getting hit by a single enemy. I dove into the cloud, hunted down maps, opened up whole secret worlds. I fell asleep like that and woke up wet from fevered dreams of Case. Saturday, still no sign of him. First thing Monday, I rode the subway into Manhattan, walked into that office like I had as much right as anyone else to occupy any square meter of space in this universe. I worried I wouldn't be able to without Case. I didn't know what this new thing coming awake inside me was, but I knew it made me strong. Enough. The poor man gave me $100, no strings attached, said to keep him in mind, said he had some scripts that I could, quote, transform from low-budget BS into something really special. He was afraid of me. He was right to be afraid, but not for the reason he thought. Case was gone, but the words kept coming. Life is nothing but acting. I could have, one, given the foster care man the $100 to track Case down. He'd call his contacts down at the department. He'd hand me an address. He'd do the same job for $50, but for $100 he'd bow and yes, sir, like a good little lackey. Two, smiled my way into every placement house in the city, knocked on every door to every tiny room until I found him. Three, hung around outside Araby Studios, wait for him to snivel back with his latest big dumb stud, wait in the shower until he went to wash out, kick him to the floor, reach up inside of him, seize hold of his heart, and tear it to shreds with bloody, befouled hands. The image of him in the shower brought me to a full and instant erection. I masturbated, hating myself, trying hard to focus on a scenario where I hurt him, but even in my own revenge fantasy, I wanted to wrap my body around his and keep him safe. Afterwards, I amended my revenge scenario list to include 1. Finding someone else to screw over, some googly-eyed blonde boy looking to plug a hole he has inside. 2. Becoming the most famous, richest, biggest gay porn star in history, traveling the world, standing naked on sharp rocks in warm oceans, becoming what they wanted me to be, just long enough to get a paycheck, seeing Case in the bargain bin someday, seeing him in the gutter. 3. Burning down every person and institution that profited off the suffering of others. 4. Becoming the kept animal of some rich, powerful queen who will parade me at fancy parties. 5. Finding someone who I will never, ever screw over. Really, they were all good plans. None of it was off the table. Outside the studio, I shut my eyes, reached out into the cloud, felt myself magnified like any other signal by the wireless routers that filled the city, found the seams of the infrastructure that kept the flow of data in place. The weak spots, the ways to snap or bend or reconstruct that flow, how to erase criminal records, pay the rent for my mom and every other sad sack in the Bronx for all eternity, divert billions in banker dividends into the debit accounts of cloud porters everywhere. I pushed, and when nothing happened, I pushed harder. A tiny pop and smoke trickled up from the wireless router atop the nearest lamppost. Nothing more. My whole body dripped with sweat. Some dripped into my eyes. It stung. 10 minutes had passed and felt like 5 seconds. My muscles ached like after 100 push-ups. All those things that had seemed so easy, I wasn't strong enough to do them on my own. Fear keeps you where you are, Case said. Finally, I could see that he was right, but I could see something else that he couldn't see, because he thought small and because he only thought about himself. Fear keeps us separate. I shut my eyes again and reached a ritzy part of town, hardly any cloud bounds in the immediate area. The nearest one was in a bar down the block. "What'll you have?" the bartender said when I got there. He didn't ask for ID. "Rocks," I said, and then kicked at the stool. "No, crap. Scotch. Scotch on the rocks." A thing in a movie. A thing a man in a movie said. "Sure thing," he said. "And for that guy," I said, pointing down the bar to the passed-out, overclocked man I'd sensed from outside. "One. Thing? The same?" I took my drink to a booth in the front where I could see out the window. I took a sip. I reached further, eyes open this time, until I found 20 more cloud porters, some as far as 50 blocks away, and threaded us together. The slightest additional effort, and I was everywhere. All 5 boroughs, thousands of cloud porters looped through me. With all of us put together, I felt inches away from snapping the city in two. Again, I reached out and felt for optimal fracture points. Again, I pushed. Gently this time. An explosion, far away but huge. Con Edison's East Side substation I saw in the six milliseconds before the station's failure overloaded transmission lines and triggered a cascading failure that killed all electricity of the tri-state region. I smiled in the darkness over my second sip. Within a week, the power would be back on, and we could get to work, whatever that would be, stealing money, exterminating our exploiters, leveling the playing field, finding Case, forging a cyber terrorism manifesto, sending a pulse of electricity through his body, precisely calibrated to paralyze him perfectly. On my third sip, I saw I still wasn't sure I wanted to hurt him. Maybe he'd done me wrong, but so had my mom, so had lots of folks, and I wouldn't be what I was without them. Scotch tastes like smoke, like old men. I drank slow so I wouldn't get too drunk. I had never walked into a bar before. I always imagined cops coming out of the corners to drag me off to jail. But that wasn't how the world worked. Nothing was stopping me from walking into wherever I wanted to go.
Love was blind to me. Now it's kind to me. Love has opened my eyes. Since it came to me, life's a game to me. With a sweetest surprise, I never knew how good it was to be a slave to one who means the world to me.
You've been listening to We Are the Cloud, written by Sam J. Miller, read for you by the author. This is Annette Henshaw.
And when he tells me he can't live without, what wouldn't I do for that man? He's not an angel or saint, and what's the odds if he ain't? With all his faults, I know he'll get by. I'll be so true to him, he'll never doubt me. What wouldn't I do for that man? For when he let me lean my weary head on his shoulder, I close my eyes right there and wish I never grow older. I'll never leave him alone. I'll make his troubles my own. I love that man as nobody can. I'm just no good when his arms are above. What wouldn't I do for that man? Oh, what wouldn't I do for that man? My own. I love that man better than I do myself. I'm just no good when his arms are about me. What wouldn't I do for that man? Oh, there's not a thing I wouldn't do for my man. That's all.
That's all. Annette Henshaw. What wouldn't I do for that man? 1927. And if you are not familiar with Annette Henshaw, get ye to one of my favorite animated films of the last decade. Sita Sings the Blues. S-I-T-A. Sita, as in the Ramayana, which is what the movie is. It's an animated version.
I like it already.
Oh, you know, it's a cross between Fleischer Animation, Flash Animation, Betty Boop.
I love Fleischer.
In terms of the look of it, and Annette Henshaw, all from the years 1927 to 29. Not public domain.
Creative Commons.
Creative Commons license, nice. Available for free at SitaSingsTheBlues.com or YouTube or Internet Archive.
Nice.
See the movie, enjoy the music.
That's great.
And enjoy the story. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you. It was really fun
That's
to read.
So abridged. I mean, I felt like, it's like, what, where are we already? We're already at that part of the story? So Do you have links to it from your... Do you have a website?
I do have a website. It's just samjmiller.com. I just did a big redesign of it, which I'm really happy about.
Okay.
My first redesign since 2007.
Yeah.
So it needed it.
Mine is like from 1996
well,
still.
Well, then now it's a vintage. now it's vintage design.
Yes.
Samjmiller.com. I have a publications page with links to tons of my published stuff, including We Are the Cloud. We Are the Cloud is also available on Lightspeed. And
that's also where the podcast is.
That's correct.
Which is not your voice.
It is not, alas.
It's Stefan Rudnicki.
He has a marvelous voice.
He has a marvelous voice, and I thought he did a very good interpretation of it. And I thought Paul Bamer did a wonderful version. I didn't know. I'd been editing J. Paul Bamer, for quite a while. Wonderful, wonderful reader. And when I told you that he did 57 Reasons for the Slate Quarry Suicides, you said, the guy from Star Trek? I'm going, no, the guy from Lightspeed and Nightmare Magazine. And I looked him up, and he's like, yeah, he's been all over Trek. He and I are going to have to... We communicate by email, but he's also going to be involved in our Queers Destroy Science Fiction extravaganza this summer on Lightspeed.
That's going to be amazing.
Yes, it is, although I don't think I'm going to edit it this time because it's all above and beyond. I'm doing 3 podcasts every 2 weeks. And that would double
the
load.
Sure.
And I have an audiobook to do during that time as well.
Where do you find the time?
I don't. The last audiobook I worked on came in a week late because I didn't find the time. It's tough sometimes.
You take a lot on. You do a lot of things.
I do a lot of things. All I have to do is earn a living at them, which is yet to happen. But on the other hand, I'm a happy camper.
There you go.
Not that many people can say they love what they do, and
that's
I do love what I do.
That's right.
Because I get to meet people like you, get to read.
Oh, stop.
No, seriously.
No, this is fun. Thank you for having me.
Having writers say this is fun, where I get to showcase them. I had you on before Professional Sales.
There you go.
And now you are a Shirley Jackson Award winner, Nebula Award nominee. And you're going to be reading this Tuesday with Samuel R. Delaney.
Which is such a dream come true, because I just adore his work so much.
He's amazing. He's brilliant. And that will be at 388 Atlantic Avenue on the ground floor. Ignore the radio station management on the third floor. I understand within a month or two, Lister, that's where we're going to be broadcasting from. 388 Atlantic Avenue, third floor. How finished it will be, I know not. The rumor was that we would be out of this facility in Harlem by the end of March. And here we are, April 16th. So not out yet, but I believe that transition is yet to come. But the ground floor, I haven't even seen it. It's been totally redesigned.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's a cafe
in
there.
Last month? Because we were just there for Ellen and Delia's. Was that December?
That was in December, and it was, and it would have been. They actually put off the renovations at that time. It took 3 months.
Wow,
that whole space is totally redone. So on Tuesday we will
break it in
together. Yeah, and there's all kinds of modern equipment. It's set up for live streaming and all kinds of stuff that the owner of that building, who was a great friend of WBAI's and a wonderful friend now of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, will be. So again, that's this Tuesday, April 21st. Samuel R. Delaney, Sam J. Miller, New
York
Review.
Open at 6:30.
Doors open at 6:30. Admission is free, but we will hawk for donations. And we have a raffle.
Oh, the raffle is the thing to come for.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my God, we're out of time. And we have a very, very, very cool raffle item. I think I told you a little about it.
You did, and I'm pretty excited about it.
I have finished putting it together, it being a virtual thing. I just need a couple of thumb drives. I need to make you one as well.
Sounds good.
And what it is, hold on, are the donated by John Joseph Adams, the actual magazine. You know what? I think this computer is stuck. The actual magazine issue, EPUB, PDF, nice, and Mobi versions of the Nightmare issue that you're in and the Lightspeed, along with the podcast, along with the Starpage. Ah! Jesus Christ, Frank. Along with the Star Pit, a 100-minute-long radio drama by Samuel R. Delaney, narrated by the aforementioned Delaney.
Sounds amazing.
And so that's on the raffle.
I may have to buy two tickets.
Yeah, well, it's any donation will get you,
right,
will get you a raffle ticket, but admission is free.
Great.
So, you know,
folks should come early because it'll be a big crowd.
Actually, it will be.
Not on my account, but on...
It hasn't hurt. It hasn't hurt. Listener, I don't know how this thing is. Oh, this thing is just stuck. And I'm not sure what to do about it. Okay, yeah. Control-Alt-Delete is always nice. But I'd like not to reboot this machine. But you see, I have no mouse control. Ah!
That'll do it.
The mouse ain't plugged in.
It's important.
Ah, you guys talk for a minute while I try to settle this for slugging a thing.
I really enjoy your stuff.
Thank you so much.
Really.
Thank you. Thank you. How are you doing?
Ah!
I'm enjoying my version of winter.
Oh, not another Game of Thrones thing. Never mind.
Where's your next appearance?
I'm going to be reading on Tuesday, April 21st, at 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. The Commons.
388. People have actually walked by there and said, I couldn't find it. And it's like, oh, come on, just look inside.
It's between where?
Oh, I don't know. It's on Atlantic Avenue, right near the Hoyt Skirmerhorn Street stops. It's every train.
You can see it from Trader Joe's.
You can see it from Trader Joe's. You can see it from the Barclay Center. It's
just a couple blocks from Junior's, which is the real draw for me. That's what I'm excited about.
Whether we'll go there after the reading or not is yet to be seen. If not, there's another place nearby. But people are welcome to come out afterward and meet Chip and Sam. And a great time will be had by all.
Especially by me, but also by others.
Oh, by me too. You know, come on. That's why I do it. Thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister coming your way over these same airwaves shortly. Good morning.
put on hold. The bull lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk. Cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my right in this right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. That I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn, like me, they yearn for the flag too. Cause my hurt is eternal, the American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies, the pigs make up. Imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call it bits cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm messy attack. The flag, I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the message must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this shit. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx.
Zítězí a poražení dneška, zítra budou vítězi. Ten... Něco hledá, věř mi, vážně nachází. Lidská vůle nezná mezí, budoucnost je nezrází. Někdy se to nezdá, ale pravda zvítězí. A poražení dneška, zítra budou vítězi. Ten, kdo něco hledá, věř mi, vážně nachází. Lidská vůle nezná mezí,
budoucnost
je nezrází. Vítku předujít, nemáte přemýšlet a zít. Každý nosí v sobě víru, stačí v sílu využít. Nenechej si namluvit, že nejít s tobou je plejřích. Společně změníme svět a nebudem se jenom přijít.
Jsme boží bojovní. Každý vlastní generál, poslouchám vlastního srdce, cestu po který jdu dál. Někdy těžký to je, když se sebou se potýkám. Jediný to, co mě drží, že v tom s váma nejsem sám.
Někdy se to nezdá, ale pravda zvítězí. A poražený dneška, zítra budou vítězi. Ten, kdo něco hledá, věř mi, vážně nachází. Lidská vůle nezná mezí, budoucnost nevyzrází. Někdy se to nezdá, ale pravda zvítězí. A poražený dneška, zítra budou vítězi. Ten, kdo něco hledá, věř mi, vážně nachází, lidská
vůle nezná mezí, budoucnost nezrází. Pokáři mají někdy navrch, ale pravda zvítězí. Vymývání mozku moc daleko zachází. Vůdci slouží korporacím, pořád jim to prochází. Si u vítr splní bůři, lidi si je ukází.
Házej nám jenom kosti kohlodání.
Musíme stát za svý práva se brát.
Krize strašák, jen reklamní zdání.
Zamyka jak všechno to, co zbylo rozprodat.
Někdy se to nezdá, ale pravda zvítězí. A poražení dneška, zítra budou vítězi. Ten, kdo něco hledá, věř mi, vážně nachází. Lidská vůle nezná mezí, budoucnost nevyzrází. Někdy se to nezdá, ale pravda zvítězí. A poražení dneška, zítra budou vítězi. Ten, kdo něco hledá, věř mi, vážně nachází. Lidská vůle nezná mezí, budoucnost nevyzrází.
Ptáš se, kde je pravda, když je lež na koni. Život je souhrou protikladů, potřeba je obojí. Každá rána dává sílu a zve lidi k odboji. Říkám, na každýho dojde a všem lhářům moc hodí.
Pravda, víra, láska, naděje. Když chováme k druhým respekt, tak na světě dobře. Chtěli jsme svobodu, máme místo toho galeje. Já doufám jen, že není pozdě, že to tady ještě dospěje. Pravda, víra, láska, naděje. Když chováme k druhým respekt, tak na světě dobře. Cinkali jsme klíče, máme z toho galeje. Já doufám jen, že není pozdě, že to tady ještě dospěje. Někdy se to nezdá, ale pravda zvítězí. A poražení dneška, zítra budou vítězi. Ten, kdo něco hledá, věř mi, vážně nachází. Dneska bude zámezí, někdy se to nezdá, ale pravda zvítězí. A poražení dneška, zítra budou vítězi. Ten, kdo něco hledá, věř mi, vážně nachází. Hledej a najdeš.
Hej, pro všechny pozitivní hlavy. Messenger, doktor Curry. Drozdov Studio.
99 Sinkle is alive right here. Your Friday is today, your weekend starts right now. S'il vous plaît, à droite à gauche. Yo, 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 yo. Flag burning time, make it 10 minutes after 3 o'clock, celebrating the demonstration in the streets in New York City for better wages, better known as a living wages. There's no such thing as a minimum wage, y'all. There is no such damn thing as a minimum wage, y'all. There is only a living wage. Don't let those capitalist pigs fool you. Hey, burn, baby, burn, 99 Cinco. Imagine. The franchises of McDonald's still sucking the blood of workers, y'all. Bam, 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 bam. Burn, baby, burn, y'all. All over the world. Fast food workers on strike, y'all. Push back.
Yeah. send you.